Isn't it good to be in church today? Thank you. This has been great. Let us turn to John chapter 6. And also, we're going to be turning into Matthew chapter 14. So if you have a finger or a little bookmark, you can turn to both. If you have your iPad, get them both up. Some of you can double screen things. We're going to look at both passages. And while you're turning to it, I just want to welcome all our visitors. Glad to have you today. Love to meet you afterwards. Please come on to the back. I'll be standing in the back with my wife, Elizabeth. Just fill out a card. Love for you to hand it to us when you come back. Introduce yourself. Anything else you might need is back there at the connection desks as well. We've been in the book of John, but we took a week off last week, and Pastor Larry preached to us. And didn't he do a good job? Thank you, Pastor Larry, for being a part. There he is over there. Good to have you. And he's only been here for about 6 weeks. And so we're excited about the work that Larry, Pastor Larry, and Jeannie are doing here at our church. If you haven't met him, go outside. He's the other tall guy out there besides me. You'll see him. And just introduce yourself to him. I took off last week. I was here sitting right where I normally do, but my son got married last Saturday to Kimberly Higgins, and the Higgins are here. They're a fantastic family, the Higgins family. So this was interesting. I'm going to share it because those who were there saw it, so I'm not sharing anything out of school. It wasn't like it was a little ceremony, but I do a lot of weddings, a lot of funerals, a lot of events, and something happened different at this one, not because I was the father preaching and doing the wedding. That was all really neat. But as I was standing there, I realized, and this is the first time it's ever happened, the two of them weren't listening at all. It was really, really amazing. I mean, I've had times where the bride and groom get distracted. They might giggle a little. They're holding hands. They're smiling at each other. But these two were totally somewhere else. And everybody in the congregation, they knew it, and I knew it, and then I realized they got to do their vows in just a minute, and they're not even listening, and I'm going to have to wake them up. And so I decided I would wake them up before the vows because I didn't want to scare them, but I thought as they were standing, they were just so great, but they were somewhere else. And so many times I thought of it, you know, sometimes you think while you're teaching, and I'm up there, I'm thinking so many times when people are hearing God's word or in a church or in a setting or even a place of prayer, they're not listening. They're there, they're smiling, they're holding hands, they're doing everything they're supposed to do, but they are somewhere else. There's something about being a human where you can physically be somewhere and mentally somewhere else, right? It's kind of a unique thing, and they were somewhere else. And that was fine, it was their wedding, it was all about them. But when we come to the Lord, a lot of times, we are somewhere else. And today, we're going to see a little of that, and we're going to wonder why. And I want us to read, we're going to start in John 6. We're going to read, it's just a couple verses. Then we're going to go to Matthew 14, because Matthew 14 is the larger story. Same story, but he gives a little more detail. Matthew does. John usually gives us an abbreviated part of a lot of the story. He's big on the sermons and small on the stories, where Matthew's big on the stories and some of his sermons. But let's read. It says, when evening came, his disciples, that's Jesus' disciples, went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. Now, we need to remember the feeding of the 5,000 had just taken place. It took place 2 weeks ago here in our storyline, but it took place right afterwards. Jesus feeds the 5,000, which was really about 15,000 to 18,000 people. He feeds them, and then he, right up in the hills, he takes his disciples down to a boat so they can go back to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because of a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, it's about 5.5 or 6 miles wide, the Sea of Galilee. So as they're rowing across, they're somewhere about 60%, 50 to 60% across. They've been rowing a long time, obviously against the wind. They saw Jesus walking on the sea, walking on the water, and coming near the boat. And they were frightened. Wouldn't you be? I mean, we laugh at these guys and go, oh, wow, Jesus walks on water. But they didn't know that at this time. They were frightened. They were frightened because they thought they were going to drown. They were frightened because they see this ghost, what they think, coming to them. But he said to them, it is I. Do not be afraid. Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. Now, let's turn to Matthew 14 and get more of the story. This is a great story, and I want to share this story. We'll share it from Matthew 14 because there's a couple of details here that aren't in the John chapter 6 account. So let me read it and add some thoughts here as we look at some things. Immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. Now, why would he do this? 18,000 people are assembled on a hillside. Here's Jesus. The 12 disciples had just taken 12 baskets, had taken 5 little loaves, 2 little fishes. Jesus broke them from that little boy's lunch, put them into 12 baskets, and they fed about 18,000 people in groups of 50 and 100. That means this whole mountainside is filled with people, and they're going. And at the end of the day, we learned 2 weeks ago, and if you weren't here, read the preceding verses, that there were 12 baskets left of food. This is an enormous miracle. But the problem with crowds and miracles is this, that the people in the front row saw what happened. The people in the front row saw a little boy come forward and saw Jesus take the little boy's lunch and put it into 12 baskets. That was you guys. You didn't see it back there. You heard them tell them who told them who told them, and in groups of 50 or 100, that's hundreds of groups, 50, and they're telling each other, by the time it got to the back, who knows what was being told, right? Except they knew that there was no food, and now there is food. So what we have here is a miracle that goes on, but it's not like the miracle, some of the miracles where Jesus raised somebody up and there was only a few people there. They all saw what was going on. Jesus says, take up your bed and walk. Everybody saw it. They all were firsthand. Most of the people were not firsthand observers of the miracle. They were secondhand observers. They received the miracle without seeing the miracle done. Now, this is important to understand, because crowds play a huge storyline in the Gospels. Crowds, masses. So here's one of our first big crowds, 18,000 people. In a few weeks, we're going to celebrate Easter, aren't we? The week before Easter, the Sunday before Easter is what? Palm Sunday. What happens on Palm Sunday? Jesus goes into Jerusalem on a donkey with everybody laying palms down so that he doesn't have to walk on the sand or ride, even a donkey riding on the dirt gets to ride on kind of a carpet. It's their version of a red carpet, so that he could go into Jerusalem. And what are they doing while they're waving these palm fronds? They're worshiping Jesus. This is the masses. Why are they worshiping Jesus? Have you ever thought of that? Why were they worshiping Jesus? They weren't worshiping Peter. They weren't worshiping John. They were worshiping Jesus because they thought that Jesus was going to take them out of the yoke or the responsibility of the Roman Empire. They thought he was going to liberate them because they looked at Jesus like they looked at Moses. Moses liberated the Jews from the Egyptians. Exodus chapter 20 and or chapter 5, 6, and following. Jesus was to liberate, in their mind, them from the Roman Empire, which was like the Egyptians. So Jesus goes in. 5 days later, Jesus is arrested. 5 days later, Jesus is arrested. And what did the crowds do then? The same crowds, what did they do? Pilate, Pontius Pilate, the governor who was brought in into Israel, we have been told through various writings, to stop all the insurrections that were going on. Pilate comes. Pilate goes, should you take Barabbas or should you take Jesus? To do what? To crucify him. The same crowd that worshiped him on Sunday said, crucify him on Friday. Thursday night, Friday. We're not sure the exact moment that it was. How could the same group do it? Because you can manipulate crowds. Crowds are manipulatable. Boy, that's not a word. Wow. I make these words up as I go. Don't worry, I get these texts from all the English teachers in our crowd. Crowds, the masses, can be manipulated. It is a fact. How do we know this? Back in Roman times, this time where this story is made, this is why Jesus pushed the disciples out, is because there was a concept known as bread and circuses. You go, what is that? Bread and circuses. Well, the Romans and the Roman Caesars were brutal people, but they had to bring all these city-states and countries together into an empire. The only way they could do it was to get the poor people on their side. If you get the poor people on your side, you can do it. So how did they do it? Two ways. They gave them bread. In Latin, it's panem, pan. They gave them bread and circuses. Circuses back then was entertainment. That's the chariot races and the gladiators. The gladiatorial fights. You see, in the gladiatorial fights, the first ring, I've been in those old places, the first ring were the wealthy, but all the stands were the poor people. And the Caesars realized that if you feed them and entertain them, they will follow you. Feed them, entertain them, they will follow you. It's been that way ever since. You can trace through history, feed them, entertain them, they'll follow you. We know Marie Antoinette. You know your French history? She said, we're not going to feed you. Let them eat cakes. They revolted and guillotined her just because they wouldn't give them bread. Those of you from Cuba, you remember Castro? Castro started with less than 150 people in Santiago in the southeast corner of Cuba. Within a few weeks, he had the whole country in his hands because the people followed him. Because he said, I will feed you, I will take over, we'll do away with the others. Those of you who come from that will remember that in 1959. It is an amazing thing. And why is that? There was a book written a couple years ago called Amusing Ourselves to Death. If you've never read it, which most of you probably haven't, it's a great little read. It's not by a Christian, but he says this, if you can amuse people, amuse. Do you know what amuse means? Muse means thinking, thoughtful. A means not. Amuse means not thinking. If you can get people not to think, they will follow you. It's an amazing thing. They will follow you if you can get them not to think. In other words, you entertain them. So you entertain them back in the Roman times with gladiator fights, with chariot races, and these kind of things. So when Jesus was crucified, how could everybody yell, crucify him? Because they were so used to people getting killed and maimed, and the circuses had animals, but the animals were there to kill the people. You see, it was entertainment. So when the Christians later on at the end of the New Testament were put to the lions, this was what was already going on, and they needed new people to do it with. So they chose to do it with the Christians. And it wasn't until the 4th century when a monk named Telemachus said, enough. And he jumped into the gladiator and he said, no more. So what did they do? They killed him. And everybody was so upset, they stopped the gladiator fights. 400 AD. This is 32 AD. So the people wanted bread and entertainment. Now think about it. What is the feeding of the 5,000? It's bread and it's entertainment. They had nothing. And all of a sudden, from this first row came food, bread, and fish. And by the end they got there, they were being entertained and getting fed at the same time. And Jesus said, this is not why I came to earth, was for bread and circuses. So, and his disciples could very easily have gotten proud, couldn't they? As if they had done anything. All they did was serve it. Jesus did all the work, but he stopped his disciples from being proud, and he stopped the people from thinking Jesus was there to give them bread and circuses. And so he sends the disciples away on a boat. He wouldn't let them walk around the crest of the lake like everybody else, because all of them would have been patting them on the back. Great job, Nathaniel. Philip, that was unbelievable. What really happened? Why, you know, and the stories would grow. And by the time they get back to Capernaum, that's 6 or 7 miles, they would have been so proud of what they did when Jesus did all the work. So Jesus sends them in a boat. Now it's nighttime, right? Because this was late in the afternoon that he feeds them. And they go in the boat and they're rowing. These boats are small boats. They found a few of these kind of boats. They call them the St. Peter's boat. The boat is about the width of this front section here, the length, excuse me, and about 3 rows deep. It is very small. These aren't ships. Small boats, bigger than a canoe or a rowboat, but smaller than the boats that we travel in today. They're rowing, and they're going against the prevailing winds. The prevailing winds come off the Mediterranean, down the mountain, and into the Sea of Galilee trough, and so they're obviously in a storm. 3 miles out or so, and they are afraid. So let's read on. Verse 23, after he had dismissed the crowds, see, Jesus was not going to let those crowds stay together. He dismissed them. He went up to the mountain by himself to pray. He was not going to stay there and have them crown him as king. So when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. Bigger words here, but the same story that the apostle John said. But when the disciples saw, and in the fourth watch, so that's all the way probably 3 in the morning. First watch is from 6 to 9 p.m., second watch 9 p.m. to midnight, third watch midnight to 3, then 3. So how long, if they just went at dark, it's probably now 8 o'clock. They've been rowing for 6 hours. Obviously getting nowhere, and they are now panicked. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus came to them walking on the water. But when the disciples saw him walking on the water, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Can I ask you to write a couple things down right now in this part? We're only halfway through it. There's another sidebar with Peter and Jesus that we'll get to in a minute. But I want you to write these 3 things down. And let me title it, "When Life Gets Rough." When life gets rough. You can put the word rough. You can add any word you want. Tough, when life is unfair, when bad things happen to good people. You can do whatever. You can put any word you want there. I have put "when life gets rough." Number one, this is what Jesus says. Take heart. Take heart. That's kind of an old-fashioned way of saying be encouraged. Be encouraged. Now, you know what the word encourage means? Well, we know what the word courage is. E-N means with, in. Encourage. Be with courage. When life gets tough, take heart. You can put any personal circumstance you want there, take heart. Or you can do what they did. Be afraid, frightened, thinking they're about to die, whatever the circumstance is. And Jesus comes, and the very first words he says is, take heart. Jesus knows you're afraid. Jesus knows you're worried. Jesus knows you're frightened. Jesus knows you're in a bad place. And he says, be encouraged. He didn't come. I can envision this. Of course, Jesus could see anything he wants, so I don't totally understand how that all works. But he's up in the hill praying. He's looking down, and he, because even though it's a dark night, he sees them out there. He knows they're panicked. He comes across the lake, I believe at lightning speed, and he's there, and he says, take heart, be encouraged. Number two, what does he say? And this is important. It is I. It is I. The real translation for this is I am. This is I am. Now that's poor English, so we go, that doesn't, but the translation should be this is I am, which means it's a direct correlation back to when God Jehovah met with Moses. And Moses saw the burning bush, and Moses was afraid. And God said, you need to do some things. And he said, who is it that is talking to me? And he says, I am. I am who I am. And we're going to discover in the coming weeks that Jesus uses I am when he says, I am the bread of life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the resurrection and the life. He goes on to speak about this, but he begins that conversation when they are about to die and that boat's about to capsize. He says, it is I. What did we just sing? It's not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. That is an incredible thing. Do we really understand that it is not us, but it's Christ who is in control? Because if you're in control of your life, the first thing you're going to understand is you don't have much control, do you? Have you ever thought about it? How much control do you really have? Do you have any? None. We have the perception of control. Because when things seem to be going good, we think we're controlling the good. And when things go bad, we say, no, we have no control anymore. Well, when the things are going good, you have no control either. You just got to understand, you do not have control of anything. You don't even have control of your heartbeat. I just breathe. Thank God. Right? I don't even have control of my breath. I don't know when my last breath will be because I have no control over it. But he does. And it is I. Do you have a belief? Can you take heart? Because you know Christ is there. And then three, he goes with the obvious. Do not be afraid. He went right to the issues. Do not be afraid. He didn't go, why are you doubting? I just fed 18,000 people 7 hours ago. Why are you doubting me? He didn't do that, did he? He said, do not be afraid. The key thing here is faith and belief. It is not Jesus walking on the water. We already know he's God. He's already said he's God. He's already done unbelievable miracles. He's raising people up that are dead, half dead, haven't walked in 37 or 38 years. He's already doing all that. They already know he's God. So he's walking on the water. That is not the biggest part of this miracle. The part of this miracle that is big is that he is in control. And so what does he do? This is great. Let's keep reading in verse 28. And Peter answered him. Now, Peter was the loudmouth. Peter was kind of the one who did things, and sometimes he got himself into trouble. Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Jesus said, come. So Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and beginning to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Now, here's the question we always have, and here's the point that always people make. Peter walked on the water. There's even books about saying, if you want to walk on the water, you got to jump out of the boat. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, can I just be honest? You are not going to walk on water. That is not the point of this story. The point of this story is that Jesus said, "Come," and Peter came. That is the point of this story. Now, in order to get to Jesus, he had to walk on water to get to him. That's the point. He came where he was told to come. Let's just think of the word "come" in the Gospels. Andrew and John came to Jesus, and he said, "Go back and get your brother." And he got Peter, and Peter came to Jesus. He didn't walk on water to get to Jesus. He walked on ground. Philip comes to Jesus, and Philip went to his friend Nathanael and said, "You got to come and see." Remember that? Didn't Jesus say something about, "Come all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest"? What are the last words in the Bible? The red letter words, "I will surely come." If I go to heaven and prepare a place for you, I will come again. The first words that Jesus said in the red letters of your Bible, "Come, follow me." The very last words in the book of John are, "Come, follow me." You see, God has called us through his son Jesus to come and follow. And what we get caught up is the water. We get caught up in what is between me and Jesus that I can come to him. And so what is between you and Jesus to come to him? That is the issue. What is stopping you from coming to Jesus? It's not physical water. You're not going to walk on water. Sorry. I mean, whatever, it's not happening. But there will be other things that will stop you from coming to Jesus. But Jesus is calling you to come to him. And then he gets there, almost there, whatever, and he starts to sink. Why? Because he took his eyes off Jesus. When you take your eyes off Jesus, you're going to sink. Not in the ocean, not in a lake, but wherever you are. The key is keeping your eyes on Jesus. And when you keep your eyes on Jesus, and what does he say? Well, first of all, "Lord, save me." Verse 31, Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took him and held on to him, saying, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" He didn't say that when he came to the boat. He said, "Take heart, be encouraged, it is I, do not be afraid." Now they're starting to come to Jesus in faith, and he falters. And he says, "Man, you don't have enough faith." And again, it's not about the water. It's about coming to Jesus. Now, how does this all work? We discover in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, but because we have more stories in the Old Testament, we discover that there are places where people come to God in the Old Testament and come to Jesus. It's quite interesting. It was at the Sea of Galilee that Peter had this incredible experience, wasn't it? Do you remember what happened? And we'll be describing this closer at Easter time. Remember Peter denied Christ 3 times? He denies Christ 3 times, terribly denies Christ, curses. I mean, just doesn't say, "I don't know him." He curses and denies him. After Jesus is passed away, he's actually already, they're up in risen, but he's up in, back to Sea of Galilee. He's back to the place where it all kind of began. And do you remember the last part of the story in the end of John? Jesus comes to Peter and forgives him and gives him a new sense of calling. And at the end of that, they're walking on the very sea, right beside it, not on the sea, but on the sand next to the sea. And they're looking out at the Sea of, I believe, they're looking out at the Sea of Galilee. And this is what he says, come follow me. As if, you remember what happened out there a year ago? It was just a year ago. It was 1 year, it was the Passover before the last Passover, so it was 1 year ago. Do you remember what happened out there and how I saved you? The Sea of Galilee was a benchmark for Peter. It was a place where he remembered what God had done for him. Do you have any benchmarks in your life? Do you have a place where you can remember what God has done for you? Do you? It's so important. Elizabeth and I sometimes walk by the place that I asked her to marry me. It's only a mile from here. Sometimes we walk by where other things have occurred. Why? Because those are benchmarks in our life. But also, there are spiritual benchmarks in our life. I brought a bench up here today, and I'm going to sit on it because I don't get to sit often. You guys get to sit the whole time. I have to stand. 2 years ago, I was on a trip to India to meet our world leaders. And because I was using frequent flyer miles, I had to come home separate from the other people. And I was in England for an extra day because of the way the flights were to save the money. And we're trying to do all this stuff. And I realized I'd be in London for like 36 hours. So we have friends who have a mother there. And I called her up. I said, I'm going to be in London for a whole day. And she used to run a museum, not run a museum, but she was a docent at a museum, and she was retired. I said, could we go to your museum, and would you show me around? She said, great. So I was staying by the airport. I took the bus out to Oxford, to the Ashmolean Museum. She had retired the year before. I said, I want to see all the great things here at this museum that you worked at all those years. So we get to it. It's in November, and I wasn't thinking, but they're on summer, the summer hours are gone, they're on winter hours, and they're closed on Mondays. And it was a Monday. After months of preparation to go to this museum, it was closed. Closed. She didn't know it because she wasn't working there. We meet at the museum. I said, I know right where it is. I'll meet you there at 9 o'clock. I meet her there, and the place is closed. I go, well, what are we going to do? I got all day. She goes, well, there's great old buildings, and I'll show you around town and all these old buildings at Oxford. So we go, and she takes us to Magdalen College, which is one of the colleges at Oxford, and it's where Chariots of Fire was filmed and where Eric Little went to school and also where C.S. Lewis taught for a while there. So as she's showing me these buildings, she said, let's go to the gardens in the back, and the British have a great way, they rename everything. A garden in Britain is called a park. So we go to the park behind it, and as we're walking, there's a bench, and it's such a beautiful, you know, English gardens are so beautiful, and there's animals back there and running freely, and I sit on the park bench, and something happened to me on that park bench like I had been there before, and I'm not mystical or magical or anything, but I had never been there before, and then I realized that I had read a story about this bench years before. It was on this bench where a man led another man to Christ. The first man was J.R.R. Tolkien, the guy who wrote Lord of the Rings, and he led his best friend C.S. Lewis, who wrote Chronicles of Narnia, Mere Christianity, and probably the greatest English author of the 20th century, to the Lord on this bench. But there was no writing on it, so I couldn't verify it. I'm just having this sense. So I stood up, and the lady I was with didn't know anything about that. I said, I just need some time. Can I walk alone? I walked alone. There was a little wall, and there was the benchmark. It was too big to put on the bench, so they put it on a little wall describing C.S. Lewis, and I knew I was here. It was the most amazing thing to realize that this was the place where God met C.S. Lewis. Now, I've been personally affected in my spiritual walk because of C.S. Lewis. Many of you have as well. And it was a benchmark there. And he wrote a poem about it, and the poem's on there, and it's just a beautiful thing. But the question I have for you today is, do you have any spiritual benchmarks? Do you have a place where you have met God? Now, we meet God every morning when we read the scriptures. We meet God when we pray. We meet God here at church. But do you have a one-on-one place where you have met God? Because God has called us to come to him. Now, he's everywhere. So the coming to him can be right where you are sitting. It's a spiritual coming to God. Back when Jesus was here, it was a physical coming and accepting him spiritually. But for us, it's a spiritual walk. And have you ever made that spiritual walk of faith to Jesus Christ? We need to take heart. It is I. Do not be afraid. Come. Let's pray together.